This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Captain Blood, by Raphael Sabatini. Read by Sayeth. Chapter 20. Thief and Pirate. Captain Blood paced the poop of his ship alone in the tepid dusk, in the growing golden radiance of the great poop lantern in which a seaman had just lighted the three lamps. About him, all was peace. The signs of the day's battle had been effaced. The decks had been swabbed, and order was restored above and below. A group of men squatting about the main hatch were drowsily chanting, their hardened natures softened, perhaps, by the calm and beauty of the night. They were the men of the larboard watch, waiting for eight bells, which was imminent. Captain Blood did not hear them. He did not hear anything save the echo of those cruel words which had dubbed him thief and pirate. Thief and pirate. It is an odd fact of human nature that a man may for years possess the knowledge that a certain thing may be of a certain fashion, and yet be shocked to discover, through his own senses, that the fact is in perfect harmony with his beliefs. When first, 3 years ago, at Tortuga, he had been urged upon an adventurer's course, which he had followed ever since, he had known in what opinion Arabella Bishop must hold him if he succumbed. Only the conviction that already she was forever lost to him, by introducing a certain desperate recklessness into his soul, had supplied the final impulse to drive him upon his rover's course. That he should ever meet her again had not entered his calculations, had found no place in his dreams. They were, he conceived, irrevocably and forever parted. Yet, in spite of this, in spite even of the persuasion that to her this reflection that was his torment could bring no regrets, he had kept the thought of her ever before him in all those wild years of filibustering. He had used it as a curb, not only on himself, but also on those who followed him. Never had buccaneers so rigidly been held in hand, never had they been so firmly restrained, never so debarred from the excesses of rapine and lust that were usual in their kind, as those who sailed with Captain Blood. It was, you remember, stipulated in their articles that these, as in other matters, they must submit to the commands of their leader. And because of the singular good fortune which had attended his leadership, he had been able to impose that stern condition of a discipline unknown before among buccaneers. How would not these men laugh at him now if he were to tell them that this he had done out of respect for a slip of a girl of whom he had fallen romantically enamored? How would not that laughter swell if he added that this girl had that day informed him that she did not number thieves and pirates among her acquaintance? Thief and pirate! How the words clung, how they stung and burnt his brain! It did not occur to him, being no psychologist, nor learned in the tortuous workings of the feminine mind, that the fact that she should bestow upon him those epithets in the very moment and circumstance of their meeting was, in itself, curious. He did not perceive the problem thus presented. Therefore, he could not probe it. Else he might have concluded that, if in a moment in which by delivering her from captivity he deserved her gratitude, yet she expressed herself in bitterness, it must be because that bitterness was anterior to the gratitude and deep-seated. She had been moved to it by hearing of the course he had taken. Why? It was what he did not ask himself, or some ray of light may have come to brighten his dark, his utterly evil despondency. Surely she would have never been so moved if she had not cared. Had she not felt that, in what he did, there was a personal wrong to herself? Surely, he might have reasoned, nothing, short of this, could have moved her to such a degree of bitterness and scorn as that which she had displayed. That is how you would reason. Not so, however, reasoned Captain Blood. Indeed, that night he reasoned not at all. His soul was given up to conflict between the almost sacred love he had borne for her in all these years and the evil passion which had now awakened in him. Extremes touch, and in touching, may, for a space, become confused, indistinguishable. and the extremes of love and hate were tonight so confused in the soul of Captain Blood that in their fusion they made up a monstrous passion. Thief and pirate. That was what she had deemed him, without qualification. Oblivious of the deep wrongs he had suffered, the desperate case in which he had found himself after his escape from Barbados, and all the rest that had gone to make him what he was. That he should have conducted his filibustering with hands as clean as were possible to a man engaged in such undertakings had also not occurred to her as a charitable thought with which to mitigate her judgment of a man she had once esteemed. She had no charity for him, no mercy. She had summed it up, convicted him, and sentenced him in that one phrase. He was a thief and pirate in her eyes, nothing more, nothing less. What, then, was she? What are those who have no charity? He asked the stars. Well, as she had shaped him hitherto, let her shape him now. Thief and pirate, she had branded him. She should be justified. Thief and pirate, he should prove henceforth, no more nor less. As bowless, as remorseless, as all the others who had deserved those names. He would cast out the model and ideals by which he had sought to steer a course, put an end to this idiotic struggle to make the best of two worlds. She had shown him clearly to which world he belonged. Let him now justify her. She was aboard his ship, in his power, and he desired her. He laughed softly, jeeringly, as he leaned upon the taffrail, looking down at the phosphorescent gleam in his ship's wake, and his own laughter startled him by its evil note. He checked suddenly, and shivered. A sob broke from him to end that ribald burst of mirth. He took his face in his hands and found a chill moisture on his brow. Meanwhile, Lord Julian, who knew the feminine part of humanity rather better than Captain Blood, was engaged in solving the curious problem that had so completely escaped the buccaneer. He was spurred to it, I suspect, by the certain vague stirrings of jealousy. Miss Bishop's conduct in the perils through which they had come had brought him at last to perceive that a woman may lack the simpering graces of cultured femininity, yet, because of that lack, be the more admirable. He wondered what precisely might have been her earlier relations with Captain Blood, and was conscious of a certain uneasiness which urged him now to probe the matter. As I said, a habit of observing things, and his wits were tolerably acute. He was blaming himself now for not having observed certain things before, or, at the least, for not having studied them more closely, and he was busily connecting them with more recent observations made that very day. He had observed, for instance, that Blood's ship was named the Arabella, and he knew that Arabella was Miss Bishop's name. And he had observed all the odd particulars of the meeting of Captain Blood and Miss Bishop, and the curious change that meeting had wrought in each. The lady had been monstrously uncivil to the captain. It was a very foolish attitude for a lady in her circumstances to adopt toward a man in Blood's, and yet his lordship could not imagine Miss Bishop as normally foolish. Yet, in spite of her rudeness, in spite of the fact that she was the niece of a man who Blood must regard as his enemy, Miss Bishop and his lordship had been shown the utmost consideration aboard the captain's ship. A cabin had been placed at the disposal of each, to which their scanty remaining belongings and Miss Bishop's woman had been duly transferred. They were given the freedom of the great cabin, and they had sat down to the table with Pitt, the master, and Wolverstone, who was Blood's lieutenant, both of whom had shown them the utmost courtesy. Also, there was the fact that Blood, himself, had kept almost studiously from intruding upon them. His lordship's mind went swiftly but carefully down these avenues of thought, observing and connecting. Having exhausted them, he decided to seek additional information from Miss Bishop. For this, he must wait until Pitt and Wolverstone should have withdrawn. He was hardly made to wait long, for as Pitt rose from the table to follow Wolverstone, who had already departed, Miss Bishop detained him with a question. "Mr. Pitt," she asked, "are you not one of those who escaped from Barbados with Captain Blood?"
"I was. I, too, was one of your uncle's slaves."
"And have you been with Captain Blood ever since?"
His shipmaster always, ma'am.
She nodded. She was very calm and self-contained, but his lordship observed that she was unusually pale. Though considering what she had that day undergone, this afforded no matter for wonder.
"Did you ever sail with a Frenchman named Cahusac?"
"Cahusac?"
Pitt laughed. The name evoked a ridiculous memory.
"Aye, he was with us at Merseybow."
"And a Frenchman named Levasseur?"
His lordship marveled at her memory of these names.
"Aye, Cahusac was Levasseur's lieutenant until he died."
"Until who died?"
"Levasseur. He was killed in one of the Virgin Islands 2 years ago."
There was a pause. Then, in even a quieter voice than before, Miss Bishop asked,
"Who killed him?"
Pitt answered readily. There was no reason why he should not, though he began to find the catechism intriguing.
"Captain Blood killed him."
"Why?"
Pitt hesitated. It was not a tale for maid's ears.
"They quarreled,"
he said shortly.
"Was it about a lady?"
Miss Bishop relentlessly pursued him.
"You might put it that way."
"What was the lady's name?"
Pitt's eyebrows went up. Still, he answered, "Miss Dora Jeanne. She was the daughter of the governor of Tortuga. She had gone off with this fellow Levasseur, and
Peter delivered her out of his dirty clutches. He was a black-hearted scoundrel, and deserved what Peter gave him."
"I see. And yet Captain Blood has not married her?"
"Not yet,"
laughed Pitt, who knew the utter groundlessness of the common gossip in Tortuga, which pronounced Mademoiselle d'Orgeron the captain's future wife. Miss Bishop nodded in silence, and Jeremy Pitt turned to depart, relieved that the catechism was ended. He paused in the doorway to impart a piece of information.
"Maybe it'll comfort you to know that a captain has altered our course for your benefit. It's his intention to put you both ashore on the coast of Jamaica, as near to Port Royal as we dare venture. We've gone about, and if this wind holds, you'll soon be home again, mistress."
"Vastly obliging of him," drawled the lordship, sensing that Miss Bishop made no shift to answer. Sombered-eyed she sat, staring into vacancy.
"Indeed, you may say so," Pitt agreed. "He's taking risks that few men would take in his place, but that's always been his way."
He went out, leaving his lordship pensive, those dreamy blue eyes of his intently studying Miss Bishop's face for all their dreaminess, his mind increasingly uneasy. At length, Miss Bishop looked at him.
"Your Cahusac told you no more than the truth, it seems."
"I perceive that you are testing it," said his lordship. "I am wondering precisely why." Receiving no answer, he continued to observe her silently, his long, tapering fingers toying with the ringlet of the golden periwig in which his long face was set. Miss Bishop sat bemused, her brows knit, her brooding glance seeming to study the fine Spanish point that edged the tablecloth. At last his lordship broke the silence.
"He amazes me, this man," he said, in his slow, languid voice that never seemed to change its level. "That he should alter his course for us is in itself matter for wonder, but that he should take a risk on our behalf, that he should venture into Jamaica waters, it amazes me, as I have said."
Miss Bishop raised her eyes and looked at him. She appeared to be very thoughtful. Then her lip flickered curiously, almost scornfully as it seemed to him. Her slender fingers drummed the table.
"What is still more amazing is that he does not hold us to ransom," she said at last.
"It's what you deserve."
"Oh, and why, if you please?"
"For speaking to him as you did."
"I usually call things by their names."
"Do you? Stab me. I shouldn't boast of it. It argues either extreme youth or extreme foolishness.
His lordship, you see, belonged to my Lord Sutherland's school of philosophy." He added after a moment, "So does the display of ingratitude." A faint color stirred in her cheeks.
"Your lordship is evidently aggrieved with me. I am disconsolate. I hope your lordship's grievance is sounder than your views of life. It is news to me that ingratitude is a fault only to be found in the young and the foolish."
I didn't say so, ma'am.
There was a tartness in his tone, evoked by the tartness she had used.
If you would do me the honor to listen, you would not misapprehend me. For if, unlike you, I do not always say precisely what I think, at least I say precisely what I wish to convey. To be ungrateful may be human, but to display it is childish.
I don't think I understand. Her brows were knit. How have I been ungrateful? And to whom?
To whom? To Captain Blood. Didn't he come to our rescue?
Did he?
Her manner was frigid.
I wasn't aware that he knew of our presence aboard the Milagrosa.
His lordship permitted himself the slightest gesture of impatience.
You are probably aware that he delivered us, said he. And living as you have done in these savage places of the world, you can hardly fail to be aware of what is known even in England, that this fellow Blood strictly confines himself to making war upon the Spaniards, so that to call him thief and pirate as you did was to overstate the case against him at a time when it would have been more prudent to have understated it.
Prudence? Her voice was scornful. What have I to do with prudence?
Nothing, as I perceive, but at least study generosity. I tell you frankly, ma'am, that in Blood's place I should have never been so nice. Sink me! When you consider what he has suffered at the hands of his fellow countrymen, you may marvel with me that he should trouble to discriminate between Spanish and English. To be sold into slavery, his lordship shuddered. And to a damn colonial planter.
He checked himself abruptly.
I beg your pardon, Miss Bishop, for a moment.
You were carried away by your heart in defense of this sea-robber.
Miss Bishop's scorn was almost fierce. His lordship stared at her again. Then he half-closed his large, pale eyes and tilted his head a little.
I wonder why you hate him so, he said softly.
He saw the sudden scarlet flame upon her cheeks, the heavy frown that descended upon her brow. He had made her very angry, he judged, but there was no explosion. She recovered.
Hate him? Lord, what a thought! I don't regard the fellow at all.
Then you should, madam.
His lordship spoke his thought frankly.
He's worth regarding. He'd be an acquisition to the King's Navy, a man that can do those things that he did this morning. His service under De Ruyter wasn't wasted upon him.
That was a great seaman, and, blister me, the pupil's worthy of the master, if I'm the judge of anything.
I doubt if the Royal Navy can show his equal. To thrust himself deliberately between those two at point-blank range, and so to turn the tables on them. It asked courage, resources, and invention, and we landlubbers were not the only ones who were tricked by his maneuver. That Spanish admiral never guessed the intent until it was too late, and Blood held him in check.
A great man, Miss Bishop, a man worthy of regarding.
Miss Bishop was moved to sarcasm. You should use your influence with my Lord Sutherland to have the King offer him a commission.
His lordship laughed softly.
Faith, it's already done. I have his commission here in my pocket.
And he increased her amazement by a brief exposition of the circumstances. In that amazement he left her, and went in quest of Blood. But he was still intrigued. If she was a little less uncompromising in her attitude toward Blood, his lordship would have been happier. He found the captain pacing the quarter-deck, a man mentally exhausted from wrestling with the devil, although of this particular occupation his lordship could have no possible suspicion. With the amiable familiarity he used, Lord Julian slipped an arm through one of the captain's and fell into step with him.
"What's this?" snapped Captain Blood, whose mood was fierce and raw. His lordship was not disturbed.
"I desire, sir, that we be friends," he said suavely.
"Well, that's mighty condescending of you."
Lord Julian ignored the obvious sarcasm.
"It's an odd coincidence that we should have been brought together in this fashion, considering that I came to the Indies especially to seek you."
"You're not by any means the first to do that," the other scoffed. "But they've been mainly Spaniards, and they haven't had your luck."
"You misapprehend me completely," said Lord Julian,
and on that he proceeded to explain himself and his mission.
When he had done, Captain Blood, who, until that moment, had stood still under the spell of his astonishment, disengaged his arm from his lordship's, and stood squarely before him. "You're my guest aboard this ship," said he, "and I still have some notion of decent behavior left me from the other days, deep and pirate though I may be, so I'll not be telling you what I think of you for daring to bring me this offer, or of my Lord Sutherland, since he's your kinsman, for having the impudence to send it. But it does not surprise me at all that one who is the minister of James Stuart's should conceive that every man is to be so seduced by bribes into betraying those who trust him." He flung out an arm in the direction of the waist, whence came the half-melancholy chant of the lounging buccaneers. "Again, misapprehend me," cried Lord Julian, between concern and indignation. "That is not it, indeed. Your followers will be included in the commission?
And you'd think they'd go with me to hunt their brethren, the brethren of the coast? On my soul, Lord Julian, it is yourself that does the misapprehending. Are there not even notions of honor left in England? Oh, and there's more to it than that, even. Do you think I'd take a commission of King James's? I tell you, I wouldn't be soiling my hands with it, thief and pirate hands though they be. Thief and pirate is what you heard Miss Bishop call me today, a thing of scorn, an outcast. And who made me that? Who made me a thief and pirate?" "If you're a rebel," his lordship was beginning. "You must know that I was no such thing, no rebel at all. I wasn't even pretended. If it were, I could forgive them, but not even that cloak could they cast upon their foulness. Oh, no, there was no mistake. I was convicted for what I did, neither more nor less. That bloody vampire Jeffreys, bad cess to him, sentenced me to death, and worthy Master James Stuart afterwards sent me to slavery, because I had performed an act of mercy, because compassionately and without thought for creed or politics, I had sought to relieve the sufferings of a fellow creature, because I had dressed the wounds of a man who was convicted of treason. That was all my offense. You'll find it in the records. And for that I was sold into slavery, because by the law of England, as administered by James Stuart in violation of the laws of God, who harbors or comforts a rebel, is himself adjudged guilty of rebellion. Do you dream, man, what it is to be a slave?" He checked suddenly at the very height of his passion. A moment he paused, then cast it from him as if it had been a cloak. His voice sank again. He uttered a little laugh of weariness and contempt. "But there, I grow hot for nothing at all. I explain myself, I think, and God knows it is not my custom. I am grateful to you, Lord Julian, for your kindly intentions. I am so. But you'll understand, perhaps. You look as if you might." Lord Julian stood still. He was deeply stricken by the other's words, his passion, the eloquent outburst that in a few sharp, clear-cut strokes had so convincingly presented the man's bitter case against humanity, his complete apologia, and justification for all that could be laid to his charge. His lordship looked at the keen, intrepid face gleaming lividly in the light of the great poop lantern, and his own eyes were troubled. He was abashed. He fetched a heavy sigh. "Pity," he said slowly. "Oh, blister me, a cursed pity!" He held out his hand, moved it to a sudden generous impulse. "But no offense between us, Captain Blood." "Oh, no offense, but I'm a thief and pirate." He laughed without mirth, and, disregarding the proffered hand, swung on his heel. Lord Julian stood a moment, watching the tall figure as it moved away toward the taffrail. Then, letting his arms fall hopelessly to his sides in dejection, he departed. Just within the doorway of the alley leading to the cabin, he ran into Miss Bishop. Yet she had not been coming out, for her back was toward him. She was moving in the same direction. He followed her, his mind too full of Captain Blood to be concerned just then with her movements. In the cabin, he flung into a chair and exploded with a violence altogether foreign to his nature. "Damn if I ever met a man I liked better, or even a man I liked as well. Yet there's nothing to be done with him." "So I heard," she admitted in a small voice. She was very white, and she kept her eyes upon her folded hands. He looked up in surprise, then sat conning her with brooding glance. "I wonder now," he said presently, "if the mischief is of your working. Your words have rankled with him.
He threw them at me again and again. He wouldn't take the king's commission. He wouldn't even take my hand. What's to be done with a fellow like that? He'll end on a yardarm for all his luck, and the quixotic fool is running into danger at the present moment on our behalf.
How? She asked him, with a sudden startled interest.
How? Have you forgotten he's sailing to Jamaica, and that Jamaica is the headquarters of the English fleet?
True, your uncle commands it.
She leaned across the table to interrupt him, and he observed that her breathing had grown labored, that her eyes were dilating in alarm.
But there's no hope for him in that, she cried. Oh, don't imagine it! He has no bitterer enemy in the world. My uncle is a hard, unforgiving man. I believe there was nothing but the hope of taking and hanging Captain Blood that made my uncle leave his Barbados plantation to accept the deputy governorship of Jamaica. Captain Blood doesn't know that, of course.
She paused with a little gesture of helplessness.
I can't think it would make the least difference if he did, said his lordship gravely. A man who can forgive such an enemy as Don Miguel and still take up this uncompromising attitude with me isn't to be judged by ordinary rules. He's chivalrous to the point of idiocy.
And yet he has been what he has been, and done what he has done in the last 3 years, she said,
but she said it sorrowfully now, without any of her earlier scorn. Lord Julian was sententious, as I gather he often was.
Life can be infernally complex, he sighed.
End of chapter 20.